Chapter 3, page 27. Thinking in Service of Understanding the World. When I observe how a billiard ball, once struck, transfers its movements to another, I remain completely without influence over the course of this process. The direction of motion and the velocity of the second ball are determined by the direction and velocity of the first. As long as I remain a mere observer, I can say something about the movement of the second ball only after it has actually begun. But the situation is different when I begin to think about the content of my observation. The purpose of my thinking is to form concepts about the process I observe. I connect the concept of an elastic sphere with certain other concepts of mechanics and take into consideration the particular circumstances prevailing in the given case. Thus, to the process that plays itself out without my participation, I seek to add a second process, which goes on in the conceptual sphere. This sphere depends on me, as is evident in my being able to content myself with observation, renouncing any search for concepts, if I have no need of them. But if this need is present, then I am satisfied only when I have brought concepts such as sphere, elasticity, movement, impact, velocity, etc., into a certain connection with each other. To this interconnection of concepts, the observed process then stands in a particular relation. Certainly the process that I observe completes itself independently of me, just as certainly, however, the conceptual process cannot play itself out without my participation. Whether my activity is really an expression of my independent essence, or whether contemporary physiologists are right in saying that I cannot think as I wish, but rather have to think as the thoughts and thought connections currently in my consciousness determine, this will be the subject of later discussion. For the time being, we wish merely to establish that with regard to the objects and processes given us without our participation, we feel compelled continually to seek concepts and conceptual connections that stand in a certain relationship to those objects and processes. For the moment, we shall leave aside the question of whether this activity is really our activity, or whether we carry it out in accord with unalterable necessity. Certainly, it is unquestionable that it initially appears as our own. We know perfectly well that the corresponding concepts are not given with the objects. That I am myself the active one may depend upon an illusion. Nevertheless, that is how immediate observation portrays the matter. Therefore, the question is, what do we gain by finding the conceptual counterpart to an event? There is a profound difference for me between the way in which the parts of an event relate to one another before and after the discovery of the corresponding concepts. Mere observation can follow the parts of a given event in succession, but their connection remains obscure until concepts are brought in to help. I see the first billiard ball move toward the second in a certain direction and with a certain velocity. I must wait to see what will happen upon impact, and even then I can only follow what happens with my eyes. Let us suppose that at the moment of impact someone conceals from me the area where the process goes on. As a mere observer, I am then without knowledge of what happens next. The situation is different if, before the process is concealed from me, I discover the concepts corresponding to the constellation of relationships. In that case, I can report what happens, even if I can no longer observe it. By itself, a process or object that is merely observed suggests nothing about its connection to other processes or objects. The connection only becomes evident if observation is linked to thinking. Insofar as we are conscious of it, observation and thinking are the two points of departure for all human spiritual striving. The workings of both common human understanding and the most complicated scientific investigations rest on these two pillars of our spirit. Philosophers have proceeded from various primal oppositions, such as idea and reality, subject and object, appearance and thing in itself, I and not I, idea and will, concept and matter, force and substance, conscious and unconscious. But it can easily be shown that the contrast between observation and thinking precedes all of these as the most important antithesis for human beings. No matter what principle we wish to establish, we must either show that we have observed it somewhere, or we must express it in the form of a clear thought that anyone can rethink. When philosophers begin to speak about their first principles, they must put things in conceptual form, and therefore they must make use of thinking. Thus, indirectly, they admit that their activity presupposes thinking. Nothing is being said yet about whether thinking or something else is the chief element of world evolution, but it is clear from the start that without thinking, philosophers can gain no knowledge of such an element. Thinking might play a minor role in the origin of world phenomena. But in the origin of a view of those phenomena, it surely plays a major role. As for observation, we need it because of the way we are organized. Our thinking about a horse and the object horse are two things that arise separately for us, and the object is accessible to us only through observation. Merely staring at a horse does not enable us to produce the concept horse, and neither will mere thinking bring forth the corresponding object. Chronologically, observation even precedes thinking, for we can become aware of thinking too only through observation. At the beginning of this chapter, when we showed how thinking lights up in the face of an event and goes beyond what it finds given without its assistance, this was essentially the description of an observation. It is through observation that we first become aware of anything entering the circle of our experience. The content of sensations, perceptions, views, feelings, acts of will, dream and fantasy constructions, representations, concepts and ideas, illusions and hallucinations, the content of all of these is given to us through observation. Thinking differs essentially as an object of observation from all other things. The observation of a table or a tree occurs for me as soon as the objects enter the horizon of my experience. But I do not observe my thinking about the objects at the same time as I observe them. I observe the table and I carry out my thinking about the table, but I do not observe that thinking in the same moment as my observation of the table. If I want to observe, along with the table, my thinking about the table, I must first take up a standpoint outside my own activity. While observation of objects and processes and thinking about them are both everyday situations that fill my ongoing life, the observation of thinking is a kind of exceptional state. We must take this fact properly into account if we are to determine the relationship of thinking to all other contents of observation. We must be clear that when we observe thinking, we are applying to thinking a procedure that is normal when we consider all the rest of our world content, but that is not normally applied to thinking itself. Someone could object that what I have noted here about thinking applies equally to feeling and other spiritual activities. The feeling of pleasure, for example, is also kindled by an object, and I observe the object but not the feeling of pleasure. This objection is based on an error. Pleasure does not at all stand in the same relation to its object as the concept formed by thinking does. I am definitely aware that the concept of a thing is formed by my activity, while pleasure is created in me by an object in the same way as, for example, a falling stone causes a change in an object on which it falls. For observation, pleasure is given in exactly the same way as the process that occasions it. The same is not true for concepts. I can ask why a specific process creates the feeling of pleasure in me, but I certainly cannot ask why a process creates a specific number of concepts in me. To do so would simply be meaningless. Thinking about a process has nothing to do with an effect on me. I learn nothing at all about myself by knowing the concepts corresponding to the observed change that a hurled stone causes in a pane of glass. But I learn a great deal about my personality if I know the feeling that a specific process awakens within me. If I say of an observed object, "This is a rose," then I express nothing at all about myself. But if I say of the rose, "It gives me a feeling of pleasure," then I have characterized not only the rose, but also myself in relationship to the rose. As objects of observation, then, thinking and feeling cannot be equated. The same conclusion could easily be derived for the other activities of the human spirit. Unlike thinking, these can be grouped with other observed objects and processes. It is part of the peculiar nature of thinking that it is an activity directed only to the observed object and not to the thinker. This is clear from how we express our thoughts about a thing compared to how we express our feelings or acts of will. If I see an object and recognize it as a table, I do not generally say, quote, "I am thinking about a table," but rather, "This is a table." Yet I could certainly say, "I am pleased with the table." In the first case, I am not concerned with communicating that I have entered into a relationship with the table. But in the second case, it is precisely this relationship that is significant. Furthermore, with the statement, "I am thinking about a table," I have already entered into the exceptional state mentioned above, in which I make into an object of observation something that is always contained within my spiritual activity, but not as an observed object. This is the characteristic nature of thinking. The thinker forgets thinking while doing it. What concerns the thinker is not thinking, but the observed object of thinking. Hence, the first observation that we make about thinking is that it is the unobserved element in our normal spiritual life. It is because thinking is based on our own activity that we do not observe it in everyday spiritual life. What I do not produce myself enters my observational field as an object. I see it as something that arose without me. It confronts me, and I must accept it as the prerequisite for my process of thinking. While thinking about the object, I am occupied with it, and my gaze is turned toward it. My attention is directed not toward my activity, but toward the object of this activity. In other words, when I think, I do not look at my thinking, which I myself am producing, but at the object of thinking. Let me read that again. In other words, when I think, I do not look at my thinking, which I myself am producing, but at the object of thinking, which I am not producing. I am in the same situation, even if I allow the exceptional state of affairs to occur, and think about my thinking itself. I can never observe my present thinking. Only after I have thought can I take the experiences I have had during my thinking process as the object of my thinking. If I wanted to observe my present thinking, I would have to split myself into two personalities, one that thinks and one that looks on during this thinking, which I cannot do. I can observe my present thinking only in two separate acts. The thinking to be observed is never the one currently active, but a different one. For this purpose, it does not matter whether I make observations about my own earlier thinking, follow the thought process of another person, or, as with the movement of billiard balls, suppose an imaginary thought process.